Okay, today we are launching back into our eighth commandment. Our eighth commandment. They are ours, but eighth commandment. Put the graphic up there. Again, in the original Hebrew, all that the passages actually say is, you know, starting from commandment 6, no murder. Commandment 7, no adultery. And today, it's equally as clear. It just says, no stealing is the eighth commandment. And so we're going to try to uncork this and sort of take a look at how our own denomination has dealt with this, how the confession looks at it. And we're in Exodus 20, verse 15, if you want to, even though we now know the passage, it's fairly straightforward. You can stare at it if you want. You know, one of the weird things about sort of getting older and, you know, staring down your 50s is that there can be extraordinary, like, reversals of fortune. And I say this to, like, the high schoolers and college students that, like, there's times in which you can feel sort of stuck within a certain destiny. I am this way, you know, forever and ever, amen. But for me, what's one of the more sort of dramatic turnarounds for me, and I can assure you that I am the most surprised by this, is that I am nowhere near as messy as I used to be. I remember my mother calling me Mr. Messy. And lo and behold, there's a book that was about my life. It's my life story. But, you know, somewhere out there, if a recording of this ever made it into the wrong hands, like, there would be seminary roommates of mine, seminary, which was my mid-20s, who would just be tickled to no end to find out that now I sort of morphed into a kind of a tidy person. If my mother was here, she would get a big kick out of this because all of my life, I mean, I was that guy who just, it was like, whatever, you know, you kind of made your way to your bed, wherever it was, and, you know, there's kind of piles there. And just by way of confession, we'll consider it sort of a purge. When I was in seminary, one of the biggest sort of altercations, like, it didn't really come to blows or anything like that. One of the worst sort of, like, altercations I had with a roommate in seminary was over pots and pans in the sink that I had let sit there that I don't want to even talk about how long. But, like, a long, long time, there were pots and pans sitting in the sink, and it was just gross and awful. And he was so, angry, and I exploded in anger one particular occasion. And referred to me, and I'll never forget this phrase when it sort of gets attached to you, as a complete slob. Like, as if you were a slob is one thing, but I was like a complete slob. There are portions of being a slob in life, and then there is the total package. I was the total thing. But here's what's so weird. Sometime after I got married, things started to change. And really, in many ways, dramatically. And most people will say, oh, but that's because, you know, you had someone there who was kind of holding you accountable. Well, no, for some reason I started caring about my closet. Now I'm kind of the straightener in my house. We just got to get the house straight. I'm going to claim we got to get it straight, and I got it. Well, what happened? I really do, I have come to believe that something changed when I actually owned the things that I was being asked to take care of. I think that was it. In other words, it's one thing to sort of pay to stay at a place that's not yours, but it's an entirely different thing to sort of own where you stay and why it is that it just takes on a new sense of significance when it's somehow that my own hard-earned money went to sort of create and make this thing happen. You know, when I was a campus minister so many years, it was always dramatic to come walking into a dorm room and sort of see what would happen in college. When for the first time, you're sort of, you know, unhinged. You know, there's nobody walking around, you know, wagging their finger at you to clean up your room, and it, you know, just like natural forces take over, and it turns into what it is. Why? Because it may not be that there's any pride in it, because my investment is not in it, personally so. Well, I use that as an illustration to say that I think the Bible is trying to teach us in the eighth commandment that there is a mysterious connection that human beings have with their things, with their stuff. Remember, in each of these Ten Commandments, what I'm trying to unlock for us is not just the big sort of cosmic wagging finger at you for what it is that you have or have not done, but rather realize that each of these Ten Commandments is trying to open up a window into how you work, how you function, how you operate better, how your sort of manufacturer's design, how God has made you to be. And what we find is, lo and behold, God has given his people stuff, things, material items that actually come to us with great power and can actually work on us in terms of how we live. This was a very big eye-opening commandment for me when we began to study this in seminary, you know, years ago, that I hope sort of creates some things for you. And so I just want to talk about this morning our things. 3 points. I want to do three things established. We want to talk about things forbidden. And then lastly, things required. Remember how we do the positive and negative of each command each week. Okay, so things established, a.k.a. my stuff, right? Here's my premise for this one point. Your possessions provide for you a very direct and quick route into your soul, okay? Your possessions, your things are a very easy path. I'm looking at a path right now down the middle of this aisle. You looking at your possessions, considering your stuff, will help you walk very clearly into your soul and understand how it functions. That's my premise, okay? Why? Well, the sense of owning something is, the Eighth Commandment is going to argue to us, both a God-given blessing, but also one of man's greatest struggles. Why? Well, notice the power of the seventh and eighth commandments. It's very interesting. Keller, in a sermon, an unrelated sermon on this a while back, says that there are almost two certain ways to mess up your life if you're really bound and determined to do so. And that is with sex and money. I mean, are there two greater issues that you would ever sort of face? I remember talking to a particularly somewhat jaded older elder in the church, and he said, look, Les, if you would like to have a successful ministry, it's relatively simple. Just avoid two things. If you can keep, number one, from running away with the, you know, with the organist or something, and number two, if you can keep from absconding with church funds, then you'll probably have a successful ministry. That felt like the bar was a little low there, but why is that the case, though? Sex and money, isn't that so true? That so much of the problems in my life, so many of the stumblings in my life, the things that I feel the most self-conscious about, tend to come from those two things. Why? Well, what Keller says, and I think this is actually brilliant, is that when the Adam and Eve were placed in the garden, think about this. Adam and Eve were given two things in the garden. Number one, they were given each other, right? They were given each other. There was a relationship that had to ask. But the second thing they were given was the garden, a possession, a thing that they were supposed to be a steward of, that they were supposed to own. So when sin then enters the world in Genesis chapter 3, does it not seem natural that the greatest havoc to be wreaked by sin is in those two areas, between my relationship sexually with the opposite sex and between me and my stuff? In other words, the more that you have, the more control we feel like we have over the universe, the better sort of equipped we are. Well, what I simply want to throw out to you is that notion, that introductory idea that my stuff means a lot to me, is actually God-given. In other words, a measure of control over whatever little piece of terra firma that God has given you to oversee is actually something that God gave. In other words, God delegates a portion of his authority and allows human beings to act as his stewards. That's a really good word to grasp as you start to understand the Eighth Commandment, that we have been given as stewards over these things. You know, a steward is not the ultimate owner of the thing. The steward is the one who is sort of taking care of it. He's a measured or a limited owner, if you will. How about this? Psalm 115, 16, some of those sort of golden little proof texts there. It says this, "The heavens are the Lord's heavens, but the earth he has given to the children of man." Now, does that mean that God doesn't own the earth? No. What it means is God, in his beneficence, has sort of granted to human beings a measure of his authority that he takes over the whole universe. This is kind of cool. This is God-given. Now, Phil Ryken used to be the pastor at 10th Pres in Philadelphia. He may still be. Is Phil Ryken the pastor?
President Wheaton.
Sorry, he's the President Wheaton. The beleaguered Phil Ryken said this back when he was a pastor. A steward is one who cares for someone else's property. That's a good definition. He is not free to use it however he please, but only to manage it in accordance with his master's intentions. God has given us the sacred trust of looking after the world. Ooh, that's cool. What a great dignity to be given as a human being, is that God has sort of given over to you a sacred trust of looking after his world and managing that to the best your ability. And so therefore, when you start to talk about your stuff, we are not talking about some detached, sort of semi-manageable area that just sort of bothers you. And I don't know, my spouse is the one who pays the bills in my office. I don't like to think about that stuff, right? No, there's something that goes very deep inside of you about that you need, the Bible says, to take care of resources. Part of life, part of executing your life, is learning to take the resources around me, manage them, and funnel them, channel them, execute them as best as I can. Now, again, as you know, that's the call to stewardship right there. Adam and Eve decided very early on that they didn't want to be simply stewards. They wanted to own outright. That's a great way to understand the fall. The temptation Satan gives is, God, it seems as if, has put, you know, sort of a measure of control around you that's not really fair. It looks to me like he's trying to keep you out of the God club there, Eve. You know, if you eat of the fruit, then all this will really, you'll know good and evil. You'll be able to decide for yourself. What's the temptation? The temptation is getting at that one thing. Suddenly, though, these God-given responsibilities become overpowering forces that mask themselves as gods. And that's my sort of summary phrase for this particular point. God-given responsibilities after the fall become overpowering forces that mask themselves as God. So that now, when we own and get stuff, it feels like an ultimate power. In many ways, and some of you are not going to believe when I say this, even feels like a power that is like unto the exhilaration of sex. Come on. You know, when all of a sudden we find out that we made the big sale, was that not a drug? When we got that raise or that promotion, or when we buy the really, really nice car. In other words, we suddenly feel that exhilaration from getting something new, something shiny, something upgraded. And suddenly it begins to feel like the meaning of life. It feels like it feels exhilarating. And at any sort of given turn in your life, or any given expenditure of your time or talents or treasures, there is always this struggle in human soul to look at that thing and to give oneself to it as an ultimate power, an ultimate authority. But of course, here's the whole idea. To do that goes against your spiritual constitution, because those things we were intended to be stewards, they were never meant to be given an ultimate ascendancy. So the power, therefore, of our things. My favorite sort of illustration about this happened actually just a year ago. And I was talking to Jason Friday about this, so he let me use this illustration. A year ago, Jason Sterling, our campus minister for Reformed University Fellowship, that's what RUF stands for, that is this denomination's official campus presence at Ole Miss, and I work for that organization, and Jason Sterling is our campus minister for that, for here at Ole Miss. And Jason last year was at our national staff training in Denver, Colorado. We head out to Denver for the winter time for our winter training, and Jason was teaching a seminar in a certain breakout room. You know, you got these big conference rooms, and they pull the little dividers around, they lock off the little things. And after he taught this, while he was teaching this particular seminar, while he was teaching, he plugged his phone into an outlet with a connector cord. And when he left the room in the middle of a conversation, he left the phone inside the room. Well, you know, as most of us do, 3 minutes later, you remember, you know, like you do this kind of thing. Where's my phone? And he goes racing back in, and the phone is gone. Well, it was fairly clear that there was someone who had been in there during those, it was no more than 3 to 5 minutes, had been in there breaking down the room and cleaned the room and had taken his phone. It was very clear. And yet it couldn't, you know, there was no one was admitting anything. No one was prosecuting anything. We got this little, you know, fuss that went on between us and the hotel. A lot of sort of things ensued. What I realized was is that one of my campus ministers was without his phone. And whatever, I don't know what essential items you need for your job, but we can't function without these. And so therefore, I was like, look, I don't care what we're going to do about the phone, finding it or not. Get in the car. We got to get your phone replaced. So as we were driving across town to the AT&T store there in Denver, you know, he was just kind of going, I could tell that he was preoccupied. And I said, this is bugging you more than just the inconvenience, isn't it? And he said, yes, it is. And I said, well, I said, let me tell you a story. This is a great illustration because there's like a story in a story. It's like Inception. You know, you got to follow which story you're in. So I said, Jason, I said, I remember when this first hit me when I was in seminary. I was in seminary in Jackson, Mississippi, and there was a little sort of set of apartments in the back of the seminary grounds where we all lived in for an extraordinarily cheap amount of money. And so while we were there one particular night, I took a break to go and wash some laundry. It was Friday or Saturday night and do some laundry. That was what my social life consisted of in seminary. And we had this small little cabin. I mean, it was no bigger than just even this little stage up here. Where they had like four big dryers and four washing machines, and you'd sit out there and put the little, it was coin operated, so you put your coins in and wash your clothes. So it's about 10, 10:30 at night one night. I'm sitting there, and I'm probably reading theology with myself. You know how it is. Again, Friday night, exciting times. And all of a sudden, these two guys come sort of busting into this room. Clearly inebriated. They were sort of some of the locals who, for whatever reason, had kind of driven onto campus. They were sort of being loud, kind of pushing each other, ha, ha, ha. And one of them looks and says, so what do you have here? And, of course, I realized what was going on, and I was like, it's a laundry room. And he was like, well, you know what? We're about to take whatever we want. And I was like, guys, I don't know where you think you are, but, like, this is not the target that you want to be hitting. And the guy, I'm not making this up, pulls out a knife and says, we'll be taking whatever we want. At which time you're like, you have whatever you need. It's all yours. But here's the thing. All they had was detergent. Because most people would leave their detergent up on this shelf up there to do it. And of course, they began to realize how hilarious this was. That they were holding up a seminary student at knife point to steal his detergent. And so they said, well, oh yeah, we'll take this. And they grabbed it and hit the door and got in their car and drove away. And here's what's funny. Like, it really didn't like hit me. I didn't feel threatened. I knew that they were kind of laughing at it themselves. But, you know, it was a knife and whatnot. And whenever that kind of stuff happens, like, rightfully so, the administration just kind of freaked out a little bit. So I, you know, the next Monday get called into the dean of students' office, you know, to make sure that I'm not psychologically damaged with PTSD from the great, you know, yeah, that's right, the great laundry scare of 1994. It was so funny because I'll never forget what Professor DeBartleben was saying. He said, I just want to make sure you're okay. And I was like, look, it really was not. I know it sounds bad, but like there was no time where I felt really threatened or really afraid. And he was like, well, I'm really glad. He goes, you know, the funny thing is about our possessions is, he said, even when it's something as mundane and dumb as a box of detergent, there's a little gnawing on the inside. And he said, the reason why is because we are made to own our stuff. And he goes, the honest thing, the reason why it bugs us when someone even comes and takes something as simple as a box of detergent, it just drives us insane. And I would argue that this is not something that we learned over time. From the very earliest of ages, what was one of the first words that your children learned to say after mama and papa or daddy or whatever? The answer is mine. Mine. They knew very intuitively that when I've got this thing and somebody walks over and is kind of like, thank you. You can watch it sort of brewing in the nursery back here and you see it go down and someone's like, mine. There's no way you can do that. It's built into us to own and to manage and to grab hold of things. But because of sin, those things threaten to tyrannize us. Does that make sense? Okay, so big first point. Hopefully, having jumped into that particular introduction, we can see why it is that the Bible begins to forbid certain things about stealing. What are these things that are forbidden? Well, stealing simply means, the definition of stealing is to deprive people of a part of the world that is theirs by right to take care of. Okay? Let me say that again. Stealing is to deprive people around you of a part of the world that is theirs by right, God-given right, I might argue, to take care of. Now look, because most of us, whenever we get to stealing, you probably thought about this when you came in, we feel pretty confident because it's like, you know, I can't remember the last time that I mugged someone on the square. I haven't like broken and entered, you know, really in quite some time. Armed robbery is really not on my thing. But of course, those particular violations are way too easy. You know, the less obvious, more subtle white-collar stealing is something that's far more likely for a room like this. In other words, the kind of stealing that if statistics are right would be what sort of upper-middle-class Oxonians would do, right? Oxfordians. It's not Oxonians. What is it? It is Oxonians. Thank you. There it is. In other words, what there is there's a different kind of stealing that goes on. And in many ways is really the thing that's actually messing up our society. It's the thing that's wreaking the most havoc. And there's all kinds of ways to steal in this way. There is theft of time. There's a theft of time where we are not sort of doing our best work. When we're not doing our best work that our employer has required of us, what are we doing? We're stealing from them our work that they require of us and that we're getting paid for. This is where the Protestant work ethic apparently came in at one time. On the other hand, if the employer doesn't turn around and pay well, then you're not giving your employees good value in exchange for their time. That's stealing in the Bible's words. How about this? When you create a product that doesn't do what it's supposed to do, you have given someone a product that was advertised falsely. It makes you wonder how much of our whole marketing industry is based upon nothing more than stealing quality from people because I didn't give them something that was in keeping with what I sold them. The Bible even goes so far as to say that if you don't pay your debts promptly, that you're stealing. You know, how many of us have expense accounts where we work, you know, money for the business items of work, which is common accepted practice in our world to sort of always estimate or budget a little bit more that you really need so that you have a little pad there to get a little something for yourself. The commandment goes on to include like, you know, pilfering public property at hotels or hospitals or building sites, maybe even churches. Ever take a hymnal home and be like, they won't miss this? What would be hilarious is if sometime during the week there was a huge wall of hymnals that appeared as the mass repentance from, I don't know if that's as funny to use as to me. It includes cheating the government on your taxes in a myriad of ways. Cheating on your time card, clocking in a little bit later even after I wasn't working. Rounding up billing hours that you didn't necessarily work. Price gouging, false advertising. How about this? Exorbitant credit card interest rates. some of you know that more profoundly than others. Insurance fraud. And look, you know, we don't even have time to talk about how much theft goes on in the intellectual and artistic property that belongs to artists. You know, intellectual property rights that people have over art that they've created or music that they've created. You know, years ago, back in the early 2000s, you know, I got as much sort of, you know, don't move kinds of zombie looks on people's faces when we would talk about the Napster revolution. I mean, the whole digital music revolution was started by a free music service called Napster, which, you know, sort of proliferated music out there, and college students were happy just to download like crazy. It was amazing how often that happened. And so here's the crazy thing, though, is when you look at how much white-collar theft exists, you'd be amazed to find out statistically how much money it costs us to be the thieves that we are. This is what's so crazy. Theft of time and property costs American businesses, according to an article written by The Economist a couple of years ago, more than $200 billion a year. $200 billion. What that means then is if 10% of the people in Mississippi got convicted by God and had an experience with Him about stealing and determined to stop, millions and millions of dollars would be pumped into our economy. If we decide, 10% decided to do that. You know, you don't have to be a budding economist to know that if you want to start a business, most products and services come with what are known as a corruption tax. I was first introduced to this topic about 15 years ago from an article I read about what was going on in California regarding automobile sales. You know, there was at least sort of 25% that was tacked on to basic goods and services dealing with automobiles just to deal with how many cars were getting stolen all the time. In other words, that's extra money that that car cost you to purchase just to pay for what it cost to deal with the plague of car theft in the state. And look, my guess is some of you in this room are able to speak with from experience to where that happens over and over and over and over again. How many departments of a business exist purely to deal with the thievery that goes on in that department? How many times does an organization, maybe even something like, oh, I don't know, a university system, have to create things in place that cost us so much money because of things that are going on? In other words, the Bible forbids stealing in all of its particular realms in order to keep it from costing us life. There is a burden that is placed upon all of our shoulders, whether we are someone who is walking through a candy store and snatching a little something knowing that they'll never miss it, or whether we're cheating on our taxes in big, bold, fat ways that if discovered we would go to jail. This is everyone's problem. It's not just those people who commit what we would call petty theft. It's everybody in this room, which I hope you're getting used to that at this point. We all sort of come into this. Okay, so things forbidden, don't steal. What things then are required? Remember, everything has the positive and negative side. In other words, we not only see the commandment condemning what we would call wrong taking, it actually also condemns wrong keeping. In other words, if we have the ability, this is the Bible's command, this is sort of unsettling in my opinion. If we have the ability to help someone in need and we don't do so, the Bible says you have stolen from that person. Now let that settle in for just a second. The Bible says that your possessions are such that if you're going to follow me and you're going to be a steward and there's someone with whom you have the power to help in your particular sort of circle of life and do not, then you have actually stolen from them. This is a jarring sort of thing. The positive side of the command is that Jesus' people are to be generous. The parable of the Good Samaritan, I would argue, says that one of the greatest marks of true Christianity is social work. That we go and look and find those places where there is human suffering, where we are able, and we attempt to meet those needs. You go to the book of James, and James says that true religion is to look after the orphans and widows. I now have two widows in my particular family, and I can tell you that there is a great burden that befalls someone who finds themselves widowed, a great burden that needs the people of God around them. There is even an enormous amount of biblical material, the latter part of Matthew and Jesus' Olivet Discourse, where he suggests that when we stand before the judgment day, that one of the great deciding factors of whether our faith was really real or not was to be determined by the way in which we gave. That'll be one of the great thermometers in that day, when all those things are said. There is plenty of Bible information that lets us know that God takes the generosity of His people extraordinarily seriously. And for this reason, Christians have been people who give their money away. It's what we do. Now, the reasons why, hold on for just a minute, we're going to get that in about 10 minutes. But Christians do this. We give it away. Now, we just do. It's a fundamental part of our existence. Why? Well, at this point, people's first instinct is to ask the question, well, you know, how much? Now, what are we talking about here? All right, okay, okay, okay. Time to get the old family ledger book out. Who uses a ledger book anymore? And what we instinctively want to know is, you know, how much? And if you stop for just a second, let me put a little time out on that before you ask the question, how much? Oftentimes, how much is a question that we ask where we don't really finish that sentence. But you might benefit spiritually from finishing that sentence. How much are we talking about? I liken it very often to the question I used to get from young people all the time, which is like, okay, Les, when we're talking about like, you know, sexual behavior that's inappropriate for me and the person that I'm dating or seeing, like, how far is too far? You know, people will tell you that there's no such thing as a dumb question. It's totally false. That's a dumb question. How far is too far? Because think about the premise of it. You know, Les, what I really need you to do is to get me as close as I possibly can get to sin without me actually having to feel badly for it. That's wrong-headed. Get me to the line. In other words, Les, get me as close as I can to, you know, stealing or not being generous. What's the least amount that I can possibly give away so that I don't have to feel guilty about you talking about it in Sunday school when this comes up again, right? That's kind of the way we feel. Well, then you dive into it. And I have always appreciated what I have taken, and the elders may correct me here if so. I've always taken a measure of joy in the fact that there was not sort of a draconian standard that was laid out to the people of Christ Presbyterian Church regarding how much God's people are supposed to give. There is some reason for us to suspect a measure of ambiguity in the amount. Just to give you some sort of idea, Malachi 3, God condemns his people because they failed to honor what is called the tithe. The word tithe there in Hebrew simply means 10%. The tithe was a tenth. That was the meaning of the word. And so it just simply says 10%. We start with a 10% tax, self-imposed, that is then given back to the Lord for us to do his work in his church and in the world. In the Old Testament, actually, Richard Pratt convinced us, my Old Testament professor from seminary, that actually if you begin to add up all of the gifts that were added up for God's people, the statistic was closer to about 27%. So when people always ask me the how much of my income am I required to give, I always say, look, 10% is a great place to start. Let's start there, shall we? Ready, go. And then see if you can move up to 27 sometime in your life as you move on. Look, I simply say that because God's people, at one of the latest reports that we've got, even our own sort of statistical data, that less than 4% of conservative evangelicals tithe their money. Less than 4. I'm talking like the conservative people, like the ones who believe the Bible, you know, like us, the good folks, right? We're the ones that are right. The PCA, this denomination that we live in, is about 7%. So don't get all high and mighty here. You hadn't cracked 10% of people that are even giving in that particular amount. Look, and I have a weird particular perspective on this, because it's not just that I belong to an organization that actually is involved in raising copious amounts of money so that campus ministers can do their work, but I also get to talk to a lot of people who interact with the people that support our staff, okay? And I'm oftentimes amazed at sort of how interesting the conversation gets for even God's people when they're like, you know what, honestly, I'll give to my church, but I got no interest in giving to, you know, I just don't like it when someone comes up and is asking for money. It just seems unseemly. Well, look, please understand something, that if our, we've done research also to know that if our denomination even gave what our denomination asks for in terms of our per communing member amount, RUF would never have to raise another dime of money. In other words, our denomination counts up how many people, okay, are a part of the PCA, then it takes our budgets,
right, that we operate on as ministries, and it divides it by the number of people in the denomination or the number of giving units, families, right, and comes up with what we call the askings. Whenever we do askings in our talk with our staff meeting, we always do this because it's hilarious. Oh, you know, that's okay. Don't worry. We'll recoup the losses from the askings because no one gives to the askings. And that's because that's all it is an askings. We can't demand anything. Now, you may look and say, well, you know, tough toenails, man. Times are tough all over there, buddy. I don't have all the money that I want to function with either. So good luck. Well, okay, that's fine. But understand what you've just done to a missionary. What did you just do to a missionary? What you've done to a missionary is that missionary now has to come back home from off the mission field and then parade himself weekend after weekend after weekend to some church so that he can get a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, a little bit there, in the hopes that sometime along the way, he'll be able to make up what his budget is. The founder of Reform University Fellowship, when he would talk about this in our staff training early on, used to weep about the damage that he was convinced was being done to families because of them not being able to be in a single church on Sunday morning, but having to be out and about, moving around from place to place, peddling his wares. Please, sir, please, would you ever? For other people, though, the problem is somewhat more subtle. They're always like, I just don't like people asking. And I always want to say, let's talk about where we are. Are you angry with the fact that God is asking money from his people? That's cool. I would almost rather you say, I just don't like the fact that God feels like he wants money because I don't want to give something to a place that I don't think is all that relevant. You know what? That is infinitely honest, and I appreciate that perspective. If this whole enterprise to you seems a bit silly, well, by all means, don't give your money to it. That would be a much more honest way. But inexplicably, oftentimes people who come and enjoy services in a church, and I mean services not like the worship service, but like a heated building with a roof and light bulbs that shine so I can see, and actually paid employees who have house notes and like cars and stuff. Is that what you object to, that those things exist? So ministries, wherever they are, if I could just make a little commercial for the fact that when that little missionary comes on and knocks on the door, please avoid that thing on the inside that says, I just don't like the idea of them asking for money. If it's God, it's either God's work or it's not. So how does that sort of function in your own heart? One little thing that you need to also realize as well, and this is where we stop preaching and go to Bedlam. If the statistics are true, the more you make, the less you'll give. Statistically speaking, the more you make, the less you will give. You know, every now and then you'll get somebody in RUF who will feel like they found themselves a sugar daddy. You know, we kind of got somebody who's really, oh, this guy is super, super loaded, man. This is going to be awesome. And I'll say this. Now that I raise money for a living as well, I spend a lot of time with rich people. Be kinder than you are to rich people, because there are responsibilities that come with that are greater than you can imagine. So small little thing. I'm not just picking on them. But a couple of years ago, I was sitting at a conference with two pastor friends of mine. This is one of those real-life illustrations where everything just kind of goes whoosh over you. Pastor number one over here is talking about a certain survey that his church did over the giving in their church, the giving amounts in their church. Upper middle class, very suburban type church in our presbytery, dare I say. And they were doing this sort of statistical survey about giving units. And he said that they found that of their particular church, that they were averaging about $1,200 per year per family in giving from their particular church. That was the average. Well, as he was relating this knowledge, he didn't mention any names. That's not what pastors do when we get alone with ourselves. You know, well, you know the so-and-sos, the Smiths. How greedy are they? He was speaking very generally. To my left, I had an African-American pastor who was pastoring a church in the inner city of a particular city in our presbytery, whose entire congregation lived below the poverty level. And he suddenly started sweating, and he was like, oh, No. You had to have that wrong. You mean $12,000 a year, not $1,200. And the pastor was like, no, $1,200. And he was like, oh, that can't be. And so me and John Stone, my friend who heard this conversation, said, dude, what are you talking about? He goes, we did the same statistical study about a year ago and found out that the amount was $1,700 per giving unit. So the inner city poverty church was giving $500 a month on average than the suburban sort of upper middle class church. Now here's what's funny. Whenever I tell that story, I get the same furrowed brows that all of you have on your faces right now. Because in your mind, you're thinking, there's no way that's right. Put me to the test. Prove me wrong. Go out there and find statistics that say otherwise. It is simply a deal where Jesus was very clear in saying, look, watch out for all kinds of greed in the Sermon on the Mount. Remember how Jesus has to say that? Watch out for all kinds of greed. He doesn't have to say that about any of the other commandments that he's that he's revamping. You know, watch out lest you commit adultery. He doesn't have to say that because apparently that's fairly clear when you're committing adultery, right? But he has to say for greed. Why? Because money just has a way of masking its own presence in our lives, does it not? There's just a way of sort of like, don't want to look at that. I don't know, what's in the checking account? We don't want to look at how those operations move. Why? I would make an argument that it's because it's tapping at something in our souls. It's unearthing something inside of us. Christians are much more like Brian Johansson, the one-time administrator of the Bowery Mission in New York City. Brian Johansson became a friend of mine. We took sort of vision trips up to New York every other year when I was campus minister here for 12 years. And Brian administrated a large mission in the Bowery called the Bowery Mission. It's a historic mission. He had started in Avenue D, transitional housing development there. But I remember I would always do whatever I could to get my students in front of Brian, because Brian gave his speech about poverty. And it went simply like this. He was like, look, I determined when I was younger that I would never give a homeless man a meal that I would not eat myself. I would never ask a homeless person to sleep anywhere that I would not sleep. And I determined that I wasn't going to ask him to wear any clothes that I would not be proud to wear. I say, that's my only standard for this whole thing. And you walked through his dormitory area where homeless people could check in and out, and you wished that you could stay there instead of the dump hotel that you got your students because it was all we could afford when we went to our mission trip to New York. We were supposed to suffer, right? They were gorgeous, clean as they could be, spotless. You wish you could have stayed there. They had a cool look to them. And the crazy thing about it was, at the time, Johansson had the lowest level of recidivism rate of any other agency working in his area in New York City. In other words, people did not come back to the Bowery Mission because when they got there, they actually got a leg up. What is it? I don't want a handout. I want a hand up. What is it? In other words, why? It's possible because he tapped into some dignity inside their souls and decided not to give them just the crumbs. What happened? Because he was generous. He was generous there. Look, generosity has both a positive and a negative side. Negatively, giving things away keeps money from ruling you. There's a pastor up in Chicago, used to be a pastor, I don't know if he's still preaching anymore, named Kent Hughes, who pastored a church right off the campus of Wheaton for years and years, who said, look, every time I give, I declare that money does not control me. Perpetual generosity, listen, this is the best sentence you've heard all week. Perpetual generosity is a perpetual deification of money. Isn't that interesting? We do not give because God is trying to saddle me with this great burden of being like, he just wants me to be poor and miserable. No, actually just the opposite. He wants you to keep from being tyrannized by your stuff. And so we give it away so that it keeps doing so. It's the same concept that we did on the Sabbath command. God isn't telling us to rest in one day in seven just because we need a nap, which may be the truth. But it's a way of looking at our work and saying, you don't define me. This is a way of telling our money the exact same thing. Positively, however, this command, I think, being generous, it says, it brings this sort of thing around, is You can only give if you feel rich. Now, look, I know a lot of rich people that feel poor, but you can only give if you feel rich. A number of years ago, one of my former students got married sort of midway through college. It was one of those where he was taking that command that Paul has very seriously about it's better to marry than burn with passion. He was like, I need to get married. And I was like, great, fine, whatever. So he gets married and learns that, like, there's a lot of responsibilities that come along with being married and a lot of financial responsibilities. And for about 2 years, you know, he was like, he was the college student that was like Charlie Brown on his way home from, you know, the tree thing. Dun, 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 dun. He was just weighted down with depression over, you know, being married and having all these financial responsibilities. You know, the car wasn't working. He had to pay his bills. Well, tragically, they found out that his father-in-law, his new wife's father, had contracted a terminal chronic disease and didn't have but a few more years to live. But in preparation for his death, his father-in-law had revealed that he was going to dispense his fortune among his three children. And it was a mighty sum, a mighty sum. Even when I heard it, it was kind of like, what? This guy is actually a PCA pastor. He is still living off that thing, doggone it. He was smart about it. But here's the thing. It was amazing how, you know, Charlie Brown dun, 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 became suddenly the dance scenes, you know, how he was walking around. But here's the funny thing. He didn't actually have possession of the money. There were years that he had to wait before he actually came in contact with the money. But the mere fact that he knew the wealth that was in his future made him feel rich today. And suddenly he began to be a better giver. Look, what this means is that Jesus in the gospel comes to make you rich. Look, one of the things that we'll not do when you talk about money, and there's nothing that'll shame, you know, quite like money, maybe the sex talk from last week, but money will shame you just as much as sex when you start talking about it. It's very easy to sort of walk around and get depressed and be like, well, you know, what are we going to do now? You know, I just bought this nice thing last week. I'm living in this house. I think we're house poor. You know, we suddenly get depressed about it. Look, that's not a very good place to start when you're talking about money. If that's a wake-up call to you, sort of get you out of your slumbers, fine. But the only way that you erode greed is by convincing yourself just how much Jesus has given you. Who, for our sakes, even though he was rich, became poor so that we could therefore have his wealth. The gospel makes you wealthy. And it may be that one of the reasons why I am so greedy is because I'm like the ungrateful servant in Matthew 18? Where's the ungrateful servant? Maybe 18. Where Jesus is coming along, he tells this story about a guy who owes a king like billions and billions of dollars, and he can't pay, but the guy goes, oh, please let me off. And the king is like, yes, I forgive you your debt. And the guy then immediately goes out and finds one of his servants who owns him like a couple months' wage. And like demand, you know, pay back what you owe. And the guy's like, says the exact same thing that he just said, please have mercy on me and I'll repay. And he's like, no. And he throws him in jail. And all of a sudden the king hears about it. You know, there's a narc in the crowd who hears that he's done this. He's like, did you hear it? And the king calls him back in and is like, I forgave you that much debt? And you demanded 2 months' wage from your servant? Look, what is Jesus saying? And why is it that the servant goes out and demands the money from his servant after being forgiven millions and billions and billions of dollars? There's two possibilities. Possibility number one is he's just a horrible person. You know, he's flippant. He's like, whatever. I'm going to be cruel as much as I want. I don't actually think that the text reads well if you take that as a perspective. I think the text reads much better when you see that the servant is going out to his servant because he's trying to pay a debt that the king had just forgiven him. You see there? In other words, he doesn't believe that the king is really willing to forgive. And that's why he's so greedy. That's why he's so anxious. That's why he's so oppressive, is he hasn't owned the fact that there was really forgiveness of that sort. Is it possible that one of the reasons why I hang on to my stuff so passionately is because inside I feel poor? I feel poor. By any measure, no one in this room is poor. By any measure, our existence here this morning means that we're not poor. But you can feel poor on the inside. And Jesus says, look, is it possible that maybe I need to convince you more that there are riches that you may not be aware of that can cause you to look at your stuff, and instead of holding them with clenched fist, we hold them like this as they come and as they go. All right? Jesus is not as greedy as you are. Come to him and get rich. All right, so questions and answers. Somebody asked the inevitable, well, how much are we supposed to give question? Because, you know, it's always, I'm not going to answer that one. Yes, here we go.
How does giving apply to trying to get rid of debt as quickly as possible? Is it like say you have this idea of efficiency where if you do something now you'll have more to give later? Do you think that's justification for, you know, hoarding, or do you think it's good to in terms of, you know, debt and giving, is it better to wait until your debt's paid off?
Yeah.
No offense to the other questions that we've gotten this particular quarter. After that is probably the best question that we've gotten yet, because it's relevant. It's on the fingertips of people. Obviously, if you've not been paying attention, college debt is out of control. Like it is a massive epidemic type problem, and you can point to a bajillion different factors that you list for people that are going at it. If you're asking about particular debt counselor, I'm going to give the Dave Ramsey thing. I'm not a financial planner. Please consult your financial professional for these kind of things. I'll say this. I do think that there is a lot of wisdom to be applied when you're a college student before you go off to school. And wisdom meaning that I have got to have some understanding of what my particular vocational field that I am pursuing will allow me to sustain when it comes to taking on certain amounts of debt. Let's face it, for most of us in high school, debt is like that word that I heard Dad use one time, not really sure where that exists, but it can be very tragic in certain circumstances. I had this brought home to me in a very dramatic way years ago when I was recruiting a young man to come work with us in RUF. He had come through Ole Miss, he and I were developing a relationship, crazy gifts and skills for ministry. And he was talking about sort of maybe going to seminary. I was trying to hook him up with a job down in Jackson, Mississippi. We were going. And because I am who I am, I'm a mid-level denominational bureaucrat, I said, I've got to ask you sort of the hard, cold questions here. Tell me what kind of debt that you've got. And he was, and then he did the, we were talking about this last night, the great sucking through the teeth coming. It's never a good sign. When someone sucks air through their teeth, that's always bad. And he said, well, I've actually got a fair amount of debt from Ole Miss. And he gave me a number. And I was like, oof. I was like, okay, look. I said, but you know what? We can work with that. That's going to work. He goes, yeah, but that's not the big part. The big part is what my wife had. Well, what happened was she had gone to a very large, very well-known private university, had built up just shy of six figures worth of school debt and gotten an English literature major. Now, here's the deal. God bless English lit majors. I'm would to God that we had more people that were in the literary arts and appreciated that. I'm not being flippant when I say that. That might not have been a very good life choice because he's out of ministry. We wept. We were at Abner's right up here. We wept together as I looked at him and said, I got nothing for you. I can't afford you. I cannot afford what it's going to take to sort of create a budget for you to get through. He had a house note that he had to pay in school debt every month that kept him out of ministry. Whew. Look, that's a small little example of saying, before you go and launch into, well, I'll just get student loans. There needs to be some grave sort of things that are sort of brought there. I think that's as much as I'm willing to say up front. For an individual, you'd have to ask for some more particular guidance. I'd love to hear some other wisdom of people that's got some ideas. There's no way, Lee, you've not thought about this before, or Errol.
Well, you hinted at Dave Ramsey, but he would talk about that God has given us a gift. gift-giving muscle.
Hmm.
And regardless of our station in life, you know, if you look at his budget forms, they start with charitable giving.
Hmm.
Obviously, he says, if you're going to claim to be a Christian, then I'm going to say your baseline is 10% of your income.
Hmm.
And he, you know, he's very solid about that.
Yeah.
But the key is, you know, he comes back to God is trying to get you to develop that gift-giving muscle.
Mm.
So if you're giving, you know, your mites or your talents, you know, either way, you're given proportionally to what you've been given to exercise that muscle.
Mm.
And to, you know, because if you don't give when you don't have much, like you said, the richer you get, the less you're going to get.
And for so many college students, when you're not immediately in control of all of the factors that go into creating an education, creating a future. I mean, you know, you're applying for jobs and you've got a concept of what it costs for my cell phone and whatnot. It's just time to get educated on it. That's what I would say. It's time to sit down and, you know, with an adult, not to be like life advice. Would you disciple me? Just sit down and say, what does your family budget look like? That'd be a pretty good question. Now, there was someone over here. Yeah.
So when you said the richer you get, the less you give, is that the richer you get, you are less likely to tithe?
Give at all. Give at all. Now, statistically speaking, the more money one makes, the smaller the percentage gets of any kind of charitable giving, or even being able to give at all in many ways. I mean, yeah. The percentage gets less and less over time as sort of wealth tends to accrue. In other words, this was the statistic from The Economist, and this is 2005, 2006, so it's a bit dated, but like, it was some crazy 90% of charitable giving donations made in America are given by the people from the $40,000 to $80,000 range. Did you catch that? So clearly, middle-class people are floating charitable giving. It's just a statistic. Yeah, Hunter?
So they tend to give to things that they love, universities, you know, schools, so forth and so on. And there's a direct correlation that if they look around their world, they don't see anyone in need.
Mm.
And so they don't have that great desire to give. And then to add ammunition to what you were saying earlier, so when we were getting ready to build at Madison Heights, we studied. And so we looked at our budget and we looked at the cost of building and what we figured out based on median income and degrees and so forth and so on. And I didn't know what people tithe as a pastor. That information was kept to me. But we figured out that we would not have needed a capital campaign to build if people had just tithe 10%.
Mm.
It was, you know, $5 million. We wouldn't need it if one kid.
Yeah. I, you know, the interesting thing is I'm not employed by Christ Presbyterian Church. I'm not compensated for my any of my commercials that I make. you can ask me not to come back, but so I feel a sense of freedom in being able to say that, like, as we enter into what we, you know, appears to be a season of building a building, I want you to be open and prepared for the fact that God may very well call you to give an eye-popping amount to building a new building. Just be prepared for that possibility. And if now that seems very remote and impossible to you, again, the reaction is not to go and beat yourself over the head with fear and guilt, but the reaction ought to be instead, I think, just, Lord, as we lead into this season, I want you to show me your wealth. Let me see what it is that I have in store. And let's not give out of a sense of sort of fear and oppressiveness and sort of anxiety and guilt, but rather a sense of, like, good grief. Look how wealthy we are, you know? Yeah. Susan.
I was in a sermon in college a long time ago where they were talking about giving, and I, that is that area I struggle in because I feel safe if I have a plan.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And the only thing I do is I think the way in which Jesus does that is not by the way in which I often want him to. I want to go to bed one night and then wake up the next morning with a generous heart. That's what I want. I want fairy dust. Bring. When the truth is, it may very well be that one of the reasons why I'm such a poor giver is that the only way I've tried to apply to my heart a generous spirit is through guilt. That's why it's so hard. And instead saying, I need you to show me your riches. That's a different request. That's a good note to leave on. Let me lean on that. Let's go to the Lord in prayer. Lord Jesus, we ask for your grace to make us a generous people. Help us not to steal, especially, Father, from those that you have called to yourself, the poor, that you have an eye upon, that you have an eye towards. Forgive us, Father, for our hoarding. Would you work against our fears, our anxieties, by showing us the greatness of your love? Even this morning, as we dwell together, as we sing your praises, as we offer our prayers to you and hear from your word, would you enlarge in our hearts and make us generous people? In Jesus' name, amen.